If it might please the court and counsel, I'd like to talk about...
Would you raise the lectern a little bit so the microphone is a little closer?
Thank you.
Thank you.
3 points were made in the briefs that I would like to expand upon here today because I don't think the connections between these 3 points were adequately discussed, particularly in regard to the compulsion argument. The 3 points I'd like to discuss are the fact that this is not a silence case and that has a particular impact on the compulsion analysis that's set forth in Frazier. The second point is that the law in regard to express invocation cases is not unsettled. And then I'd like to discuss the fairness issue that was raised and I think is brought to light in the government's brief.
Well, excuse me for a second. We note that you were appointed under the Criminal Justice Act.
Yes, I was, Your Honor.
And the court wants you to know we deeply appreciate your willingness to accept the assignment.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. When the district court decided this case and in the government in its brief did its analysis, the reliance was almost exclusively on cases involving silence. The Frazier and Asuna Zepeda case, both from the Eighth Circuit, are both post-arrest silence cases. The Zanabria and Rivera cases from the Fifth and Eleventh Circuit are also silence cases. And I think we need to start by distinguishing and understanding that silence cases are fundamentally different than in a case like Mr. Long's, where there was an express invocation of his right to remain silent. Persistent silence in the face of an accusation affirms the accusation. But the invocation of the right to remain silent does not affirm or deny the accusation. It's a necessary act to trigger the privilege. We know going back as far as Minnesota versus Murphy, 50 years or more ago, that a defendant or a suspect is not entitled to receive the benefits of the privilege unless they make an affirmative act to invoke it. And so that's why an express invocation case is different than a silence case. The other thing about a silence case, and this is noted in several of the decisions that we cited, is silence is inherently ambiguous. It does not beg a resolution, whereas an invocation is unambiguous, and it puts the government and law enforcement on notice that a privilege is being sought, or at least the protections of the privilege. How this relates to the compulsion argument, I think, is fundamental to understanding why the reliance on Frazier and Asuna Zapata is not appropriate in this case. Both the district court and the government note that if silence is not compelled by government action or not induced by government action, the Fifth Amendment is not implicated. But in an express invocation case like Mr. Long's, the opposite dynamic occurs, and it's almost unrelated to whether there was government action. We know from Minnesota versus Murphy and all of its progeny that Mr. Long had to take an affirmative step to invoke the privilege. He had to ask, or he needed to raise the issue in order to get the benefit therefrom. So regardless of whether there was government compulsion or inducement, he had to do something to get the benefit of the privilege. And so what we have in a express invocation case is really a situation, and it goes to the injustice or the unfairness argument, is a choice between three evils. If we penalize a defendant for invoking the right to remain silent, by allowing that to be used against him, allow the jury in the government's case in chief to draw an adverse inference against him. And if we allow the government to similarly use silence in the face of an accusation in their case in chief, then there is no option that the defendant or the suspect can take other than to answer the questions put to him by law enforcement, which then potentially incriminates him or her. And so there is no outcome where the defendant can get the benefit of the privilege without getting the adverse inference presented to the jury in the government's case in chief. And that's why I think when this court decided Frazier and Asuna Zapata, it very specifically said it was only extending the holdings in those cases to silence cases. It did not expand them beyond silence cases. One of the statements made in the Oakerton decision, which we rely on heavily, that really brings this compulsion dilemma to a point is the court in that case said, quote, individuals must not be forced to choose between making potentially incriminating statements and being penalized for refusing to make them, unquote. But that's essentially what the government's argument is. If you look at page 24 of their brief, the government says, we can use in our case in chief the invocation of the right to remain silent or silence. Either way, we can use that against the defendant. And that just puts the Fifth Amendment into a subordinate position to a rule of evidence that was not intended. And the Coppola decision makes that point. The Coppola decision very artfully discusses how any invocation of a privilege can lead to an adverse inference. And if we create a rule of evidence that no matter what the defendant does can be used against him, then essentially what we're doing is enshrining in the jury or endorsing the notion that the Fifth Amendment is merely a shelter for wrongdoers.
In the context of a non-custodial interview, mm-hmm. isn't this an unsettled question?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because...
Well, didn't the Supreme Court take this issue in Salinas and then not decide it?
They decided, yeah. The plurality decided that only on the issue of silence. They didn't address this issue, but in Salinas, it was a silence decision. It was a silence. The facts of that case were silence. They did not go beyond that to, and that was the decision, the distinction between the plurality decision and the secondary opinion was the justices of the secondary opinion said they would expand the ruling to both silence and invocation cases, whereas the plurality just decided it on the invocation basis. But we've got decisions from the 1st, 2nd, 6th, 7th, and 10th circuits, all where it was an express invocation, and they all decided it the same way. And both the Oakerton decision and the Coppola decision, which was way back in 1989, did their review of the case law, and they said there's never been an express invocation case where, in this pre-arrest, pre-Miranda context, the invocation has been admissible except when the defendant testified, and then it was used for impeachment, which is the big distinction here, is this was in the government's case in chief, and it was used in a case where the defendant did not testify. So we don't want to have a rule of evidence where we're telling the jury that the Fifth Amendment is the bastion of wrongdoers, and this is just a shelter, because we know from the case law and the cases that review this all the way back to the drafting of the Bill of Rights, this was meant to protect the innocent as well as the guilty, and so we don't want to diminish the significance, particularly where we have said to people like Mr. Long, if you want the benefit of the privilege, you have to assert it. So it's fundamentally unfair to say that on the one hand and then allow the government to tell the jury that the only reason he took that was because he had something to hide. And that's what happened in this case. And this was a close case. We've got no forensic. We have no witnesses. We have an allegation on its face that has some substantial credibility issues. The young person involved in this case said that she had been raped or molested 40 or 50 times in a 90 to 120-day period in a house full of adults and children, yet there was nobody who witnessed it. The jury was out for 7 hours, and they did return a verdict of not guilty on one count. So this was a close case. So what did the government rely on? In its rebuttal argument, at the very end of its case, one of the last things the jury heard was the reason he took the Fifth was because he had something to hide. The government argued exactly what our founding fathers did not want to happen. They did not want people's silence to be used against them as substantive evidence, but that's what happened here. And so there isn't a real issue of it being unsettled in this procedural context. And anywhere the trial counsel would have looked, all of the published decisions, whether it was from, and I admit there was not a decision on point in the Eighth Circuit, but any other circuit the attorney would have looked, there were decisions on point that said this was inadmissible. And I see I'm eating up in my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Very well. We'll hear from the government. Mr. Goldner, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel? I'm Kevin Colliner. I'm here on behalf of the U.S. Attorney's Office in South Dakota presenting for the government. We are asking this court to affirm the district court's order dismissing Mr. Long's petition in this case. The issue at this stage of this case on a 2255 appeal before this court is a very narrow question. It's whether his trial counsel, she was constitutionally deficient when she failed to object to the government's use in its case in chief of this pre-arrest, pre-Miranda statement by the petitioner that he did not want to incriminate himself. Now,
does the government concede that this statement was an invocation of his Fifth Amendment rights?
Of course, he never mentions the Fifth Amendment. He never says, I would like to remain silent. What he says is, I don't want to incriminate myself. And I guess I'd let the words...
Did he go on to say, I don't want to talk?
I think, yeah, that's right. He does, Your Honor. He says, I don't want to talk. And the agent ended the interview at that point. So we don't know, anything further that might have been said after that if it went on. So those were the words that were used.
Okay, but try answering my question. Do you concede that that's an invocation of his Fifth Amendment?
You know, in Salinas, the plurality opinion talks about invocation as the key words, and he says that. Incrimination, and he says, I don't want to incriminate myself. So those are the words that are used. And so
the answer to my question is yes?
I believe so. On direct appeal, this court has already made several findings that are important and relevant here. One is that there's no governing precedent directly addressing the admissibility of that statement. That's something this court has already decided. And that's given the holdings in U.S. v. Frazier in 2005 and also the case out of the Seventh Circuit, U.S. v. Davenport. This court held that that there was no clear error clear or obvious error. In U.S. or in Fields v. United States, which the government believes is the most important case at this stage, the precise question was addressed: if there's a split of authority, if there is a failure to object, which is what happened in Fields as well, if there's a lack of Eighth Circuit precedent, and if there's a lack of Supreme Court authority. And in Fields, they had the same issue now. Even years later, they said this question has not been, the law is still unsettled. This court wrote, it must be said that counsel's performance fell within the wide range of professionally competent assistance.
Okay, so here we have no Supreme Court precedent.
Right.
No Eighth Circuit precedent.
The Eighth Circuit precedent, Fields, and then citing Davenport with approval.
Silence cases, though, right?
Well, those are cases that hold that that the Fifth Amendment isn't implicated when it's a pre-custody interview. So, and in fact, those cases talk about how the compulsory nature, the fact that they're pre-custody is the central question for Fifth Amendment purposes.
Was there a split on pre-custody invocation cases? I think the other side says every circuit court went against your position.
The other side is citing cases like Okatan. That's a 2013 case, right? So that's post, and that's a footnote. I mean, you take a case like Davenport, where we have another similar scenario here. Now that's different than an invocation case, but that's a case where you have a defendant who did precisely for relevant purposes what this petitioner did. He went down the road of exculpation, and then he, in the words of Davenport, he clammed up. That's another case cited in the direct appeal here, cited with approval. I don't see how the application of that principle would be any different with invocation versus silence. I also heard it said that that a defendant, you know, has this a difficult decision that they have to take some affirmative step to raise the privilege. We have all these silence cases that talk about Fifth Amendment privilege. I don't think there's an affirmative step that's necessary. You can remain silent, right? That has been held in various contexts to invoke the privilege. So, you know, that was the scenario that this defense lawyer found herself in. As this court has held, lack of precedent, lack of Supreme Court authority. And the line of cases is very clear on what that means for a 2255 appeal. Fields v. U.S., New v. U.S., U.S. v. Allen, those are all cases cited in the brief, in the briefing. The key inquiry is, of course, at the time of trial, what was the state of the law? And at the time of trial, this was pre-Salinas, pre-Ocotan, and in fact, you know, even today, I would say the same, because Salinas didn't decide this ultimate question, and there's been no intervening case in this circuit. So that, in the government's view, decides the question entirely, because the first step of Strickland is to determine whether or not this counsel fell below that Strickland-level constitutional standard. We also, after the opinion on direct appeal, went back and had an evidentiary hearing. As this court's well aware, there's a high level of deference given to trial counsel strategy. And so counsel was asked questions about, you know, why she did what she did. She, in that hearing, testified that she had thought about this issue. She had done some research. She decided that this statement was likely to come in. She didn't want to draw attention to it to the government by filing any pretrial briefing. She thought, in fact, that the real harmful part of the statement that was made to the agent that day was about how this girl had come up behind him at a computer and started to rub herself against him. That, of course, was one of the allegations in the indictment, that about an incident that happened that surrounded this use of the computer. That's what she was most concerned about. And she said on cross-examination at the hearing, you know, I kind of wish I hadn't cross-examined the agent as I did. Now, the standard on 2255 isn't, you know, that every cross-examination has to go the way you hope it would. If you look at that record on the cross-examination, she asked some questions, and she drew out that the agent didn't know what was in his mind when he said that he didn't want to incriminate himself, and then went on from there. So, again, there was a strategy behind this, and this court gives due deference to that strategy. The district court also talks in its order denying this petition about the prejudice prong. And on direct appeal, there's, you know, kind of two issues here. One is about the closing. This court has already held that the closing was not clear error, and that there was no prejudice from the closing, because in large part that statement was simply reiterating the jury instruction that dealt with the right to not take the stand, and contrasting that with this statement. The district court also talked a great deal about the evidence in this case. The victim of the three counts testified extensively. She talked about these 40 to 45 sexual assaults. She testified that she told about 10 people before law enforcement was notified, outcry witnesses. Multiple of those witnesses testified at the trial and testified that she had told them pre any law enforcement involvement. There was also a Rule 413 witness who testified about this petitioner's systemic abuse of her in a very similar situation when he was living in her home. I just heard it said that there were no witnesses. when counsel was going through, you know, the list of supposed infirmities about that case. But those are all the witnesses one expects in a case like this, and they all testified, and clearly the jury found them credible.
Back to the final argument issue, you say our prior decision has foreclosed any further development of that issue?
I'm sorry.
Well, you say that the panel's decision in the direct appeal, in effect, said that there was no error in the statement about he had nothing to hide, or that he had something to hide.
What the prior decision held was that there was no authority governing this issue at the time, and it was decided on a plain error standard at that point. But given that there was no authority at the time, that also decides the performance prong of the 2255 analysis, given the cases like Fields v. U.S., New v. U.S., and U.S. v. Allen. So the 2255 issue is specifically left unresolved in the opinion, but those issues were resolved.
Well, what was left on 2255 then?
Well, at the end of the...
Before 2255 analysis.
At the end of the opinion, it's written that there needs to be some further evidence developed with respect to the counsel's trial strategy.
And again, on the 2255 hearing, I've forgotten what counsel said about the... did she fail to object to the prosecutor's statement?
Yes, she did.
Was that a deliberate thing on her part?
Yeah, she said she didn't want to make a big deal out of it. She didn't want to draw attention. And she also failed to file a motion in limine on the issue. And she failed to object at closing.
It may have been strategy, but was it plausible strategy?
Well, absolutely, given the unsettled state of the law.
Well, I don't know. Under the unsettled state of the law, the government was free to comment on the defendant's invocation of his right to silence?
No.
Will you concede that the statement should not have been made by the prosecutor?
No, I wouldn't concede that, because we have here a pre-Miranda, pre-custody statement, and arguably invoking rights. This court has held that in that context, pre-Miranda, pre-arrest, that it is not a violation of Fifth Amendment rights for the prosecutor to comment on that in its case in chief. That's the Frazier case. That's also the Ozuna Zepeda case.
Except as you know, Frazier didn't reach the issue of an express invocation of Fifth Amendment.
And that's the distinction that's being made here. I don't see that has a distinction with respect to Fifth Amendment rights. What right would be violated in the opposition's view? It would be a Fifth Amendment right. Now, Frazier says that's not a Fifth Amendment moment when you're pre-custody. There's no compulsion. And the level of compulsion is the key analysis to determining whether or not it's a Fifth Amendment moment. That's Justice Stevens' concurrence in the Jenkins case, and that's the Rivera case that's also cited in some of the briefings. So that's where the key split lies. It's not in a question of whether it was the words themselves used to invoke or silence itself. It's whether it's a Fifth Amendment moment, whether there's a right that's even implicated. Now, again, at this stage of the game...
In other words, pre-arrest, pre-custodial statements are fair game for the prosecution.
Silence or an invocation or a desire to remain silent are fair game, as long as they're relevant. And that's separate.
Suppose Long had not asserted his privilege when he did. Would he have surrendered something? He would have been left in a precarious situation of either having his silence used against him for his failure to invoke it, or else continuing to incriminate himself.
Well, this is the reasoning in the Davenport case. When you have someone who is voluntarily, not compelled to be there, and who tries to exculpate himself, right, agrees to talk to law enforcement and tries to go down this road of exculpation and then clams up, the prosecution is allowed to use that contrast in its case in chief. That is...
Isn't the invocation of silence, as he did here, in effect transfer the non-custodial to a custodial setting?
No. He was allowed to leave right after that. He was told before that he was...
After he incriminates himself, then he's entitled to leave.
Well, he was told at the outset he wasn't under arrest. He wasn't under arrest that day. All the Griffin warnings were given.
The invocation of his right to silence is irrelevant.
Is irrelevant to...
To anything. Is it ever relevant to anything?
Well, the relevance issue is not what's in question here on this appeal. It's a Fifth Amendment.
Relevance to his later assertion at trial.
At trial, he didn't testify. So it was the statement used then at trial by... The other part,
In effect, he testified himself versus via your. I don't know if you made the closing argument or not. But he testified himself by his invocation of silence.
Well, that statement was used in the case in chief. Now, we also argue that wasn't prejudicial. That we have a harmless error argument as well. So, I think that also goes to your question. I noticed that I'm out of time at this point. So,
well, thank you for your.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Murphy, is this much ado about nothing? Does the pre-indictment, pre-custodial aspect of the case make your argument irrelevant?
No, I don't think so at all, Your Honor, because the Fifth Amendment jurisprudence says that the government just said the Fifth Amendment wasn't implicated at this pre-arrest, pre-Miranda stage. Certainly United States versus Huffman and Jenkins and any number of U.S. Supreme Court cases have said the Fifth Amendment should be liberally construed. It doesn't matter what words are used to trigger it. There's no magic words. And it is not limited to custodial status. It's available at any stage, which distinguishes it from the right to counsel, which only is triggered at a stage when there is an adversarial process.
Isn't compulsion part of it, that the government has to compel it?
Well, no.
In a non-custodial situation, do you really have compulsion?
You have compulsion in the sense that you have to do something affirmative to invoke the protections of the privilege. We know that from dozens of cases since Minnesota versus Murphy, and that's why the analysis for a silence case really doesn't apply to an express invocation, because the government started out by saying he could have just remained silent. Well, no, he couldn't. If he had just remained silent under that compulsion analysis, the government could come in and say, because it's pre-arrest, pre-Miranda, we can bring in that he stayed silent. So to trigger the privilege, regardless of whether there was government act, there's sort of legal compulsion. Under the case law, he is compelled to do something to say, I want the protections of the privilege. And so that's why the silence analysis just doesn't apply when there's an express invocation. It's also a problem with the way the government's construed this clamming up issue. If you look at the cases that they cite, like the McCann case, that's where somebody is selectively trying to answer certain questions and not others. And McCann, he said, I'll answer some questions, but when they got to the question about whether he'd given a fake name, he said, well, I'm not going to answer that. In this case, when the topic at heart, when Agent Rice said, I want to talk to you about this molestation allegation, Mr. Long said, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to incriminate myself. She understood that as an invocation, and the interview stopped. He did not selectively pick and choose questions. The court questioned Mr. Colliner about the trial counsel's strategy, and I think the focus has to be, was it reasonable strategy? This attorney knew the area of law. She had successfully excluded a statement that was arguably much more legally tenuous than this, because that was a silence in the face of the accusation. She didn't object prior to trial. She didn't object at trial. She exacerbated the situation by her own admission by asking multiple questions of the agent that only dug the situation deeper. She didn't object during closing. There was nothing reasonable about her position. She got no benefit. If she had objected prior to trial and the court had ruled in her favor, we wouldn't be here. If it had ruled against her, she would have at least preserved it for appeal. What she did was she said, I didn't do anything because I didn't want to make a big deal out of it. As noted in the evidentiary hearing, the agent, her report was only one paragraph long. It contained this statement and the other statement referenced by Mr. Colliner. This was sticking out like a sore thumb. She knew it was a problem. She should have objected. That's why on appeal we were subject to plain error analysis. One of the issues that was asked of Mr. Colliner was the issue of whether this was unsettled. And he referred to the Oketon and Davenport decisions and Salinas and said, well, those are recent decisions. They summarize case law that goes back to the early 80s, as does the Coppola decision, that in every instance when a express invocation came before the courts, they always ruled that that was inadmissible in the government's case in chief. So the fact that Salinas and Oketon are relatively recent doesn't detract from the fact that there's case law back to the 80s. Thank you. I see my time is out.
Very well. We thanks both sides for the argument. The case is now submitted.